Earlier this year, President Obama unveiled plans to launch the Obama Presidential Center in Jackson Park on Chicago's South Side. Today, we ask, what role have presidential libraries played in the communities in which they're built, and what does the community there think about the center now? Plus, we continue our back-to-school week with a discussion about vaccines with Illinois' public health director, Dr. Nirav Shah.
Vaccines are at their most effective when everyone in a community is vaccinated, or as many people as possible.
We also revisit our conversation about the Illinois connection to the Trail of Tears.
It's heartbreaking because, you know, this happened to our people, and people don't really, people forget about it. People forget about the Trail of Tears, and people need to see this kind of stuff. They need to understand the history.
That's all coming up after the news. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Former President Barack Obama unveiled plans for his new presidential library back in May, except you're not supposed to call it a presidential library. The Obama Presidential Center will be built in Jackson Park on Chicago's South Side. The foundation says it's designed to be a campus with classrooms, outdoor spaces, opportunities for civic engagement. President Obama says he wants it to be an economic engine for the South Side. Here's what he had to say about it back in May.
Is that if we do this well, not only will this end up being a world-recognized institution where people from not just around Chicago, not just around the country, but from around the world come to teach and learn and work with each other, but it's also going to be a transformational project for this community, that it can... that it can bring economic development opportunities to this community.
That's President Obama back in May. Since then, community activists in Chicago have been putting pressure on the Obama Foundation to make sure that any economic benefits from the center actually go to local residents. Earlier this week, the Chicago Sun-Times reported that a watchdog group called Jackson Park Watch sent a letter to the city of Chicago arguing that the planning process has been too secretive. There are meetings about this week. There was a meeting last night. There's a meeting this evening between the foundation and community residents. We wanted to talk about all of this. Joining me in our studios at the Medill School of Journalism in downtown Chicago, Jawanza Malone is the executive director of the Kenwood Oakland Community Organization. On the line with us from the University of Louisville is Professor Benjamin Huffbauer, where he teaches art history. He's author of the book Presidential Temples. Gentlemen, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us.
Jawanza, let's start with you. There was so much passion around where this center would be built from the minute that it was announced, even when there was all of the jockeying before location was chosen. There were lots of different neighborhood groups. So I want to start by asking, how do you feel now about the Obama Center being built on the South Side of Chicago?
So I think overwhelmingly people see it as an opportunity. But like with any opportunity, there can be benefits or there can be some significant challenges. And that's what we're facing here. The reason why we are pushing for a community benefit agreement is because we believe that we want to see, as the president does, and we just heard some of his words, we want to see benefit for the broader community. We appreciate the fact that this historic institution is going to be situated on the South Side of Chicago. But we also know with large-scale development, some of the harms that can come with it include displacement. And so we don't want that to happen.
Displacement is important because you're saying you don't. By that, do you mean you don't want the neighborhood to... What exactly do you mean? Do you want the neighborhood to get too expensive that people are forced out of the neighborhood? Or do you mean literal people will have to move for other things that might be planned around it?
We don't want people to be displaced or pushed out of the community because of increasing rent and property taxes. We already have, before Jackson Park was announced as the location for the Presidential Center, we had speculators who were buying up lots and properties, and that speculation has already driven up rent and property taxes. There was an article that came out a couple of months ago that said that property value in Jackson Park has gone up 20% already. And so we know with increasing home values, while that's a boon for homeowners, at the same time, when you have property owners, that increased value get passed on to renters in the form of increased rent. And when we have a situation, as we do in Chicago, where half of the city is paying more than 30% of their income just on rent, any increase in rent, especially the kind that we're seeing around where the presidential center is going to go, unfortunately, it tends to displace people.
I think people who are listening might think that that's an unfortunate byproduct of economic progress, right? You're smiling because I'm sure people have said this to you, that everybody was so excited about this because they want economic development in their neighborhood. How do you manage that tension? Because that's a really tough, obviously, we're talking about people's homes. We're also talking about bringing hopefully some real economic progress to areas that have desperately wanted this for decades.
I'll just start by reiterating that's why we want a community benefit agreement.
So you want a written document.
We feel that something that is negotiated with the community. See, just to cut in here for a second to my own thought, part of what we get is that for some reason, people feel as if the community has unreasonable expectations and demands. We aren't talking about anything that's unreasonable. Simply what we are talking about is what we've seen across the country where developers have established community benefit agreements with the community to ensure displacement does not happen and that there's broader benefit to the community that's long term. Oftentimes when we hear about the hundreds and thousands of jobs that come with construction projects, we understand that those are largely temporary jobs. We aren't just asking for construction jobs. We're asking for economic development to really ripple throughout the neighboring communities. We also feel that if the foundation, the City of Chicago, and the University of Chicago sit down and negotiate what it is that we would like to see in the benefit agreement, is something that will benefit all. It's win-win for all parties involved. When we look at the fact that the University of Chicago is going to directly benefit from the fact that the presidential center is being built blocks away from their campus, they've already announced the creation of a new convention center. They've already announced the creation of a new hotel. These things are going to provide direct capital benefit to that institution. But again, where does the community lie in terms of benefit to all the communities that's involved?
That's Jawanza Malone. We're talking about the new Obama Center, the Presidential Center that's going to be built in Jackson Park on the south side of Chicago. I want to bring Ben Huffbauer into this conversation. He's author of the book Presidential Temples. Ben, I'm thinking about how different this is from the other prominent presidential library in Illinois, the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library Museum in Springfield. It's in the middle of downtown Springfield. There's not any, you know, there's not really any, it's not really in a neighborhood. It's right there. I wonder how, and obviously this is not something that President Lincoln had anything weighing in on because this opened just a decade or so ago. I wonder how, when we're talking about modern presidential libraries or centers, how does what the Obama Foundation is talking about compare to other presidential libraries and centers that have been built in the modern era?
As you quoted at the beginning, President Obama had a pretty progressive message that he was sending out, and I think it is appropriate that the Kenwood Oakland Community Organization is trying to get that, some of that in writing, and I think that makes sense. In general, presidential libraries, as something that you didn't quote, that President Obama said, presidential centers tend to be about what he said is ego tripping, and I think that's really true. Presidential centers, for the most part, past ones, have been about promoting the image of that president through museums of spin, basically, that are not very historically accurate, and other stuff. It seems like already he's trying to get away from that model. No doubt that there will be spin at the Obama Center, as at all other presidential libraries and centers, but it seems like he's trying to look at a bigger picture of the community within which the center is going to be built and what kind of economic development can result. Although, as has already been said, that can be a mixed blessing sometimes, is that with rising rents and other things, some people win and some people don't.
Ben, as you've written about presidential libraries, you've been following this issue. As you've heard the plans unfold, and as you've seen what they're hoping to do, and as you're hearing from Juanza, I should add, by the way, we did reach out to the Obama Foundation. They declined our request for an interview to join us in this conversation. Ben, what stands out to you in this process? I mean, is this typical? As you said, the center is different in that it's the idea that it's a center. Is it also different in the process of which the foundation is having to negotiate and has a very active community of neighbors who want to be a part of the process? Is this an unusual thing also?
Yeah, I think it is somewhat unusual. I mean, every presidential library or center has a local community base, obviously. But in Chicago, a whole nother level in terms of the size of the city compared to where most presidential centers are located. And so, and the very fact that President Obama, as we've already said, mentioned economic development as part of the purpose of this whole center, local economic development, that is something new and different that hasn't been at the top of the list for past presidential centers. The Carter Center, for instance, quite famous, established back in the 1980s, their tagline is waging peace, fighting disease, and building hope. But mostly they don't do that in Atlanta, where the Carter Center is located. They do that, you know, around the world. President Obama seems to be focusing his presidential center a little bit more in the local area than past presidential centers.
That said, Juanza, what have you heard from the Obama Foundation about your concerns? You all have asked, again, for this written document. What's been their response to you all?
Their response has been that the Presidential Center, being situated on the south side of Chicago, is benefit in and of itself. We feel that that is not necessarily true. We, again, recognize this is an opportunity, but it's an opportunity that has yet to be realized. And all the things that the president talked about, he wants the center to provide and to do for the South Side, is something that we welcome. Our only request is, again, that it be placed in writing. When we started, the city of Chicago was essentially granting 21 acres of parkland to the private foundation that bears the president's name. Now we are looking at 35 acres of parkland that will be under the control of the foundation. And so our concern, our point, our argument 2 years ago when we started this was that this is a very slippery slope when you're dealing with a private institution utilizing public assets with very little community process.
Ben, do you have anything else to add as you're listening to all of this?
Well, it'd be interesting and probably, I think, a very good thing if that could be done. My guess is that the Obama Center, as they're developing it, they're still not sure what all they're going to do and how much money they're going to have. One of the things that President Obama did that was different than other presidents is that he didn't raise money in office. And as someone who's sometimes been a critic of presidential libraries, I think that's a very good thing that he didn't raise money while in office because of the obvious problems with conflicts of interest. But as a result, he's kind of behind, my guess is, in terms of fundraising. No doubt they will have a healthy fundraising campaign, but they're really still at the beginning of that. As opposed to many presidents, by the time they leave office, it's really pretty advanced. But because he didn't do active fundraising while in office, they're just still really getting that going.
And Juanza, as you're hearing that, I'm sure your response to that is even more than ever, you now want to be part of that process.
Exactly. And that's the point. So when the president presented his vision for the center on the campus of the University of Chicago some months ago, he shared that he wanted to see a parking facility built. Of course, this was, again, something we raised 2 years ago that, you know, obviously some people were going to need someplace to park, and we weren't hearing what the plan was. We wanted to know if it was going to be in the 21 acres, if it was going to be outside the 21 acres, just what the plan was for that. And we hadn't heard anything until the president made his announcement. At the time he made the announcement, he also said that he did not want the foundation to have to pay for it. which would have put it squarely in the lap of the taxpayers. Now, we're hearing that the foundation is planning to pay for it. And so we understand there is some back and forth negotiation that is happening behind closed doors. We simply are asking to be brought into this process. You have a residential area that sits right there where the presidential center is going. And so by, you know, estimates, anywhere between 500,000, 800,000 people will be traveling to that part of town every single year. What's going to happen with the vehicular traffic and the increased pedestrian traffic? How is that going to increase public transportation? How is that going to increase all the things that everyday people care about? And so we're hearing the presentation, but we aren't necessarily hearing answers to these critical questions. And I want to be clear that we aren't opposed to the presidential center. Our only point is that if there is intended to be community benefit, community needs to be included in that process.
That's Juwanza Malone. He's part of the community, as we've been hearing, on the south side of Chicago. He's the executive director of the Kenwood Oakland Community Organization. As we're talking about all of this unfolding, we'll continue, of course, to have conversations about the Obama Presidential Center. But I want to thank Juwanza and also Professor Ben Huffbauer. He teaches art history at the University of Louisville. He's also author of the book Presidential Temples. Juwanza, Ben, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Listening to the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. Students all across Illinois are heading back to school this month. In addition to back to school shopping and haircuts and taking those first day of school pictures, parents also need to get their children up to date on their vaccines. To talk about this now, we're joined on the line from Springfield by Dr. Nirav Shah. He's director of the Illinois Department of Public Health. Dr. Shah, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
It's great to be with you.
Do parents need to know about back-to-school immunizations? I know you've been involved in, IDPH has been doing a back-to-school vaccines campaign.
Well, this is the time of year that folks are getting their kids ready to go back to school. And we want to remind everyone that as you're getting your backpacks and your school supplies and all those things ready to go for your kids, now is also the time of the year to make appointments with your child's pediatrician or family practitioner and make sure your child is up to date on vaccines. Sometimes those appointments can be tough to get. And so now is really the time to start calling and making sure that you've got an appointment on the books to make sure your child is up to date.
Now, I know that there's some new efforts to limit or discourage vaccine exemptions, the state of Illinois. I want to talk about that in a minute, but I first want to ask you how Illinois has been doing in recent years in terms of vaccination rates.
Quite well. Overall, Illinois children have gotten their vaccines in remarkable numbers. Although it varies by specific vaccine just a little bit, it's safe to say that well over 90% of children in Illinois across the state have received their entire complement of vaccines. This is really important for a few reasons. The first is that it ensures that those kids themselves are healthy. But I think the really important public health point is that vaccines are at their most effective when everyone in a community is vaccinated, or as many people as possible in a community is vaccinated. This produces something that scientifically we call herd immunity. When above a certain number of people have received a vaccine, it means that those who might not be able to get the vaccine, maybe because they're too young or they have a health condition that means they can't get vaccinated, those people get protection by virtue of everyone else around them being vaccinated.
And I want to ask you about that because we've, you know, we've gotten a lot of feedback from, and I'm thinking in particular of people who maybe are never, maybe not necessarily vaccinating their kids, but maybe they're thinking about, for example, saying they support vaccine choice, right? So maybe they're not saying that they're anti-vaxxers, but maybe they'll get, for example, MMR, but they won't do chickenpox or HBV because they don't think the risks are really that big, and they prefer to selectively vaccinate. What are the health risks to that?
Well, the health risks from foregoing vaccines for someone's immediate child is that that child could become susceptible and, in fact, acquire the disease. One of the vaccines in some parts of the country, though not necessarily Illinois, but in some parts of the country, parents have been foregoing vaccines for a disease called whooping cough, or pertussis, it's also called. And what we've seen as a result of this avoidance of that vaccine is actually a pretty striking resurgence in cases of whooping cough in many parts of the country. This is a disease that, when I was in medical school, was pretty much unheard of, but now we're seeing cases creep up and up and up. And this is a direct result of parents deciding that the risk isn't really worth it, and they'd rather not get their kid vaccinated. But these choices have direct consequences, again, not only for one person's child, but for the entire community. It could mean that someone who's very elderly, who can't get the vaccine, or a child who's very young, who isn't old enough to get the vaccine, as a result of not enough people having the vaccine around them, those folks, the very young, the very old, could actually become susceptible to the disease themselves.
Do we know in particular why maybe people are avoiding the whooping cough vaccination?
You know, it varies, and we've heard different explanations from different folks. And a lot of the concern arises from a more general concern about vaccine safety. Early on, there were concerns that vaccines might have been linked to autism. I want everyone to know that this link to autism has been as thoroughly debunked as any claim in science could be. But more recently, there have been concerns that children are being what some folks have called being over-vaccinated. But here again, these vaccine schedules are made using the best data that we have and have been tested and tested and tested for decades. And there really is no data to suggest that any child in the United States is being over-vaccinated. And as we see vaccine rates falling, really the concern that we're worried about is children being under-vaccinated. And that's why we really urge parents, even if you don't think your child might be at risk for, say, whooping cough or mumps, we urge you to get your child vaccinated, maybe not to protect your child, but to protect other vulnerable folks in the community who really themselves can't be vaccinated.
Right. So is there any evidence to suggest? I know one of our producers was speaking with moms in Illinois who say that they're going to do this delayed schedule. Is there any evidence to spacing out the shots being better for young children?
I want to be really clear here. There is no evidence or benefit to the so-called delayed schedules. They actually come with a certain risk. These delayed schedules, which the agency, the Illinois Department of Public Health, does not endorse, neither does the CDC, the Institute of Medicine, or the World Health Organization, or the American Academy of Pediatrics. None of those organizations endorses these so-called delayed schedules. They do not make a child any better off, and even more concerning is that they don't protect a child fully. So some of the things that we mentioned earlier, a higher risk of disease for the child or people in their community, that becomes a real threat after a while. Now, we understand that folks have questions and concerns about vaccines. And of course, we want every parent to ask hard questions to make sure that they're doing what's best for their children. And so we urge everyone to take a look at our website, to take a look at the CDC's website, and if they still have questions, chat with their doctor. And, you know, hear firsthand from someone's doctor about what the real risks of not being vaccinated are. I think the best evidence comes from pediatricians themselves. All the pediatricians I know vaccinate their kids, and that's something you can trust.
Let me ask you, because you're the director of public health, Illinois Department of Public Health, and I feel like you, as you said, you're fighting sort of, I think, in a way, a battle against people who have maybe already made up their minds. And it may be not even that they don't trust the science. They're just not seem they don't seem to be concerned that they're not convinced that the risks outweigh the benefits, especially if they've read horror stories online of the small percentage of cases of reactions that do happen, right? Because I think that's something everyone in the medical community also acknowledges. What should they, what advice do you give to parents? Like, what questions should they be asking their pediatrician? What questions should they be asking their doctors? And what to maybe alleviate those or try to change their minds?
That's a great question, Nyla. And the first thing I want all of your listeners to know is that we at the agency are not in the business of telling people what to think. I understand that people have legitimate concerns that they feel very strongly about. And so the first question I always ask when someone calls us or when I meet somebody who has concerns about vaccine safety, the first question I always ask is, why do you have these concerns? Where did your concerns come from? And is the concern related to perhaps a child that they have who did have a reaction to vaccine? Was it something that they saw on television? Was it something that they may have seen or been passed along from the internet? And what's really motivating this? Is their concern really a general skepticism of, say, the pharmaceutical industry? Is it a concern of why governments are telling them what to do with their kids? I always want to make sure we get to the heart of what they're really concerned about. But the question that I would urge your listeners who have inquiries about vaccine safety to ask their doctor is honestly the one that I think you can get the most information from, which is, doctor, do you vaccinate your kids? And if the answer to that question is yes, and I strongly speculate that in Illinois the answer to that question is almost always going to be yes, that to me tells me everything I need to know. If one of my loved ones needed a procedure or was recommended a medication, the question I always ask for example, my parents' doctors is, doctor, if this were your father or your mother, would you recommend this course of treatment? And the same thing should be the same question that skeptical parents ask their pediatrician about their kids. And that is, I think you can learn a lot from that question.
So I know the state of Illinois recently has made an effort to limit or discourage vaccine exemptions by requiring parents to get a certificate signed by a healthcare provider. What's the idea behind that requirement for people who perhaps may have some sort of, and I guess in this case, I think the most obvious one is perhaps a clear-cut religious objection?
A while back, the General Assembly, the legislature in Springfield, decided that individuals who wanted to avail themselves of one of these exemptions, you mentioned the religious exemption, the legislature wanted to make sure that parents who were doing this on behalf of their kids had the latest and greatest scientific data at their fingertips before they made this decision to forego their child's vaccination. So the General Assembly passed a law that required what has been come to known as informed refusal. So if a parent would like to exercise their right not to vaccinate their child, the intention is to make sure that that refusal is based on the best available scientific information. So as a result of that, the law reads that any parent who wants to exercise this right has to visit a healthcare professional and have a certificate signed. And this form requires the physician or the healthcare provider to explain the risks of foregoing vaccination to a parent's child. And the hope is that after hearing the latest science, some parents might opt to change their mind and vaccinate their child. But alternately, if they continue to decide not to vaccinate their child, they'll at least do make that decision with all the facts on hand.
And what would qualify then as an exemption? Is it just the healthcare provider then that determines that, or what is the criteria?
It's a good question. So the way that this is structured is that the healthcare provider, him or herself, is not making the decision about whether the parent can exercise this exemption. That decision still rests with the parent. The only thing that the healthcare provider is attesting or certifying is that he or she has provided the education about the risks of foregoing the vaccination. So that's really all that's entailed. And the General Assembly's idea was to make sure that parents had all the data on hand before they made what could be a very life or death decision.
For parents who don't have insurance, Dr. Shah, or for whose provider won't accept their insurance, I want to just sort of shift topics here and ask about where they can go for to get required immunizations for their children. Is that something they can go to the health department for? Where can they go?
The first place that we recommend that parents go or call is their local county health department. It varies by county, but many counties across Illinois, their health departments are able to provide vaccines at low or in some cases even no cost. And it varies by health department. It also varies by vaccine. But to any of your listeners who are struggling financially with getting their child vaccinated, we would recommend you call your local county health department. And at a minimum, they might be able to help you navigate where you should take your child and what would be the best place to take your child to get those really important vaccines.
Okay. We'll have all of that information up at our website at 21stshow.org. After the program, we'll tweet out links now as we're speaking with Dr. Nirav Shah, the department, director of Illinois Department of Public Health. You know, Dr. Shah, just as we wrap up this conversation here, we've spent a lot of time talking about children's vaccinations. But how important is it, as you're talking, we started this conversation talking about herd immunity, how important is it that adults also stay up to date? Because I think we forget. We get all of these, those of us who've gotten all these vaccinations as kids, they don't last your whole lifetime as an adult.
That's exactly right, Nyla. And this is a great time of year. As parents are taking their kids to the doctor to get their kids vaccinated, it's a great time to check, to have those parents check on their own vaccine statuses. A lot of vaccines aren't really regularly administered until folks are older, sometimes even into adulthood. And so this is a perfect opportunity to speak with your doctor, check in to make sure your own vaccines are up to date. A lot of folks get their vaccines from their primary care provider, but not everyone goes to their primary care provider once a year for that annual checkup. And so as folks are getting their kids ready to go back to school, this really is the perfect opportunity to check on their own vaccines and get up to date with those. As you mentioned, Nyla, some vaccines have to have boosters well into adulthood, and other vaccines aren't even started into adulthood. So while you're getting your kids vaccinated, it's always a good opportunity to check on yourself.
Well, probably, I would say realistically, for parents going back to school, at least make the appointment, right?
So you can at a minimum make the appointment right. And make the appointment now. We all know that when there's a crush of people wanting to get into the doctor, those appointments can become pretty scarce real estate. So at a minimum, call your child's doctor today. And while you're doing that, take a minute to focus on your own health and call your own doctor to make sure you're up to date.
Right. That's Dr. Nirav Shah, Director of Illinois' Department of Public Health. Really quickly, Dr. Shah, we just have a little bit of time left, but I just wonder very quickly, what's the schedule for adults for remembering sort of like what's the most important vaccinations adults have to remember?
Well, I will say the adult vaccination schedule is almost as complicated as the schedule for children. But some of the vaccines that are required in adulthood include things like boosters, for the various vaccines that you might have received as a child, tetanus and such things, but then the pneumonia vaccines, and of course the flu vaccine, which children get, but it's equally important for adults to get, are all things that that really should be visited and discussed with one's doctor. The full vaccine schedule is available on our website as well as on the CDC's website, and we urge everyone to check there to make sure that they're completely up to date.
We'll have all of that. We'll tweet all of that out as well. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Shah. I appreciate you taking the time.
It's my pleasure, Nyla. Thank you.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
I'm Nyla Boodoo, and this is The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. In the 1830s, tens of thousands of Native Americans were removed from their homes in the southeastern U.S. They were forced to march west for hundreds of miles. Thousands of people died along the way because of starvation and disease. The path that Native Americans were forced to walk became known as the Trail of Tears. Today, the memory of the Trail of Tears lives on for Native Americans, and for members of the Cherokee Nation, that path ran through southern Illinois. That may come as a surprise to you that the Trail of Tears ran through our state. Back in May, three Trail of Tears sites in southern Illinois were added to the National Register of Historic Places. That's the official list of historic sites overseen by the National Park Service. Today, we revisit the conversation we had about these sites when the announcement was first made. Mark Wagner is an associate professor and director of the Center for Archaeological Investigations at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. He's the one who proposed these sites to the National Park Service. Troy Poteet of the Cherokee Nation also joins us. He's executive director of the Trail of Tears Association. Troy, thanks for being with us.
I'm glad to be here.
Troy, what does... Yeah, thank you so much. I wonder if you can explain to us what it means to you to have these Trail of Tears sites marked as official historic sites.
I think that the marking of these sites, tribal folks look on this as an opportunity to tell a broader story. It gives us opportunity to honor the endurance, the perseverance, the strength of our ancestors who did not let the tragedy of forced removal define their lives. They came to what's now Oklahoma, and they rebuilt the Cherokee Nation, and they passed it on to the next generation, a distinct political entity. They didn't let removal destroy us. So when we look at these events, it's an opportunity for us to honor them, not as victims, but as people who overcame.
And Troy, when you think about that, I think about the fact that I know now many Native Americans today, in honor, as you said, of this, retrace steps that that your ancestors were forced to walk. And I think when you think about that, I wonder, I know this is a big question, but I wonder if you can help explain, especially for our non-Native audience, what the Trail of Tears, what you think it represents, especially for the Cherokee Nation?
Especially for us, it represents a testimony to our ancestors' perseverance and their will to survive as a tribe, as a distinct public political entity. So when we look at that, it's a symbol that we come from a background of people committed to the preservation and of the Cherokee Nation. And its perpetuation is the word I'm looking for, to mm-hmm. the preservation and perpetuation of our tribe. That's what we see when we look at that. Yes, we see injustice. Yes, we see a tragedy, but we don't like to perpetuate the image of our ancestors as victims. And we don't look at this and say, golly, somehow we want to appropriate that victimization to ourselves. That's not it. The idea is that they had to endure that, and they rebuilt notwithstanding. And so when we're coming across southern Illinois just a day or two ago, maybe only yesterday, a group of young Cherokees are riding they're organized into an annual Remember the Removal bike ride, and they travel across the same area that our ancestors did, stop at some of the same places that our ancestors stopped. They're joined, our Cherokee Nation youth are joined by people from the Eastern Band of Cherokees, those folks who managed to stay in the original homelands. And where the young folks are able to make that ride because of volunteers in the local communities, like the Illinois chapter of the Trail of Tears Association, like Dr. Wagner and Sandy Boaz, they have been partners with the Trail of Tears Association in helping the Park Service find exactly where did the route go, are there sites there, are there places that were there that were witness to what happened in 1838 and 39.
That's Troy Poteet from the Cherokee Nation, Executive Director of the Trails of Tears Association. We're talking about the fact that the National Park Service, the National Register of Historic Places, added three Trail of Tears sites in southern Illinois to the register. I wanted to bring someone else into this conversation. The man who helped propose some of these sites to the National Park Service, Mark Wagner, is an associate professor and director of the Center for Archaeological Investigations at Southern Illinois University, joining us on the line from Carbondale. Mark, thanks for being with us as well.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
Mark, as we're hearing Troy talk about these specific sites that some young folks were just riding of just recently, can you tell us a little bit about these sites? One was a campground, one was a church. What happened there?
Oh, sure. Well, in the winter of 1838 and 1839, the northern route of the Trail of Tears ran through southern Illinois. And over 10,000 Cherokee traveled along that route in very bad weather. And there were several locations that they would stop at and camp at. And two of those are Campground Church and Cemetery. And that was an existing, kind of like a revival or a campground for religious meetings. And the other one is called the Bridges Tavern. And taverns in the 19th century are more like hotels. And it also had a big campground associated with it. And there were so many people in these groups. Some of these groups numbered over 1,000 people. And they could not, there was not enough room in southern Illinois to accommodate them. So they needed places to camp. And two of the places were, again, Bridges and Campground Cemetery. And Campground Cemetery, while the Cherokee were camping there, several of the Cherokee, we don't know how many, died. And the man who owned the property, who was Mr. Holloman, two of his sons had died just the year before. And it was the start of the campground cemetery. And he allowed the Cherokee to bury next to his sons. And that area where the Cherokee are buried has always been kept vacant in the center of the cemetery. So we know where those graves are. And so that is one of the sites that got nominated. We have a very strong historic association, historic records for it. But also, a few years ago, a geologist at SIU, Dr. Harvey Henson, used ground-penetrating radar to survey that area where the Cherokee burials are reportedly located. And he did, in fact, find evidence without digging, got signals that there were graves in that area. And so we were able to make that argument that this this indeed is a Trail of Tears site and should be placed on the National Register. The Bridges Tavern is also, it's a very similar sort of place. It was a frontier hotel, but it had a large campground next to it, and it also had things that the Cherokee would have needed. It had like a blacksmith, it had a mill to grind corn, all these things that a number of people would have needed. And one of the things that at the Bridges site was that there was a log store that they were able to purchase things at. Well, that log store still exists inside a modern barn at that site. And so we went out there a couple of years ago, and we did archaeology and we did archival research, and we also documented the log structure in detail. And it does appear to go back to at least the mid-1800s, and it has a oral history. A very strong oral history that it was a store, and it does indeed appear to be a store building. So again, in this case, we're able to make the argument by tying together archaeology and archival and oral history that this indeed was a place where the Cherokee stopped. And this log building is one of the very, very few extant buildings along the trail. There may be one or two other ones.
Troy, are there other actual buildings that still exist along the trail, or is this a rare site that we have in Illinois?
There are many structures along the Trail of Tears. There are several, I guess I should say, not many, and we're in the process of identifying those. And so Dr. Wagner has some counterparts in other parts of the country who are busy about finding these sites. We have chapters in 9 states that the trail touched, and in each state there are several structures.
And Troy, I wonder if you could illuminate for us. Oh, go ahead, Doctor. Go ahead, Mark Wagner. Go ahead.
Oh, my point was that in Illinois, there are only a very, very few, maybe one or two.
Not
for the entire trail. I'm talking about southern Illinois.
Okay, thanks for clarifying that. And also, Mark, can you tell us specifically where these first two sites, where they're exactly located, what towns they're in?
Yeah, Campground Cemetery is located east of Anna, Illinois, in Union County, and it still has an active Presbyterian church at it. And, it's an active church and a cemetery, and there are interpretive signs there. And so people can go out and, you know, read it and look at the interpretive signs put up by the National Park Service. The Bridges Tavern is on private property in Johnson County, and that the structure is not visible from the road. And you would have to arrange, if someone wanted to go see it, they would have to arrange with the owner to be allowed to go see it. And then finally, I was going to mention the third site that people can go see also in southern Illinois is on the Shawnee National Forest in Union County, and it is west of Jonesboro, and it's called Hamburg Hill Trail. And this is where a section of the trail ascended a very high ridgetop, which is Hamburg Hill. And the trail, all the traffic, not only of the Cherokee, but of other travelers along the trail, have worn this deep trail cut into the ridgetop. It's probably as much as 20 feet deep. And so we actually have a living link to the landscape that the Cherokee would have seen. When you go out to Hamburg Hill, you see there are no modern buildings, no modern structures, no telephone poles. You see the same landscape that they would have seen in the 1830s, traveling down through that trail cut.
Wow, that's quite a view to think that hasn't changed during that time. That's Mark Wagner, who's an associate professor in anthropology. He's also the director of the Center for Archaeological Investigations at SIU in Carbondale, talking about these historic sites. Troy Poteet, who's with us as well, who's executive director of the Trail of Tears Association from the Cherokee Nation. Troy, you started this conversation by saying that I think what struck me was a lot of this to you is about story, not just obviously the story of the Trail of Tears, but the story after. I was surprised to even learn that there were sites in Illinois where this even happened. I wonder how much of this is about sharing not just that past story, but the current, as you said, sort of the story after the Trail of Tears with everyone across the United States.
I think that it's both. It gives us an opportunity to talk about a bigger story about that our ancestors did persevere and hold the tribe together, and that we did prosper again in a new land, and that we are today again enjoying a new age of prosperity and revitalization of our language and our culture and our traditions. Right now, we are overcoming what happened when we were forced to become part of the state of Oklahoma, and our land base was divided against the wishes of our people, against their advice, and 90% of Cherokee's land was lost between 1906 in 1936 when the droughts and the Dust Bowl hit. And so we are overcoming in this current age what happened at that time when our people became strangers in their own land and fell into poverty because of it. So it's an opportunity for us to tell that larger story, but the work that, like Dr. Wagner is doing, Sandy Boaz is president of the Illinois chapter, Mary Corvey at the Forest Service is part of that. There's a huge number of people, a good-sized number of people who donate their time and their talent to determine exactly where the trail ran, what sites are there. And so that's where our history intersects the history of the people in southern Illinois. There are many stories about people coming out. They wanted to bring blankets or medicine. They couldn't go into the camps because there was disease broke out and they were sort of quarantined. There's all these sort of stories that connect us as Cherokees with the people in southern Illinois. So every year it seems like we appreciate the partnerships that we are able to develop with people.
Yeah, thanks so much for sharing those partnerships. I'm afraid we're out of time today for the 21st, but I want to thank Troy Poteet from the Cherokee Nation for joining us to learn a little bit more about this. You've been listening to the 21st, a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.